Chapter 10. Fulfillment. In May, Angel Clare returned to England with two letters in his pocket. He went briefly to his parents at Emminster, then hired a gig and set out to find his wife. His parents were shocked to see how much he had changed. His face was thin and his eyes were anxious. He wore a beard now, which made him look much older than he was. Clare passed the stone pillar at Cross in Hand and went on to Flintcomb Ash, to the address from which her letters had been sent. None of the villagers there could remember anyone called Mrs. Clare. They had known Tess only by her Christian name. Clare found this discouraging. Her refusal to use his name, like her refusal to go to his father for help, showed a dignified sense of their total separation. And here, for the first time, Clare understood the hardships she had suffered in his absence. The farm workers told him that Tess had gone to her parents in Marlott, and so he continued his journey. Clare's gig entered the lovely valley in which his dear Tess had been born, and descended the green slopes to the village of Marlott. The villagers told him that Mr. Durbeyfield was dead, and Mrs. Durbeyfield and the children had left Marlott. Clare began to despair. He went for a walk through the village to plan his next step. He passed by the field where Tess and the village women had danced all those years ago. He passed through the graveyard and saw John Durbeyfield's grave. On the gravestone were engraved these words: John Durbeyfield, rightly d'Urberville, direct descendant of Sir Pagan d'Urberville, a knight of William the Conqueror. How the mighty are fallen. The people who now lived in the Durbeyfields' cottage gave Clare Joan's present address. He hired a gig and went there as fast as he could. Clare had never met Joan before. When she answered the door, he noticed that she was a good-looking woman in respectable widow's dress. She looked at him nervously. He told her he was Tess's husband and that he was looking for Tess. Joan was reluctant to give him the address. She said she was sure that Tess did not wish him to find her. But Clare did not believe her. He remembered Tess's first letter.
"Please tell me her address, Mrs. Durbeyfield. In kindness to a sad and lonely man."
Finally, Joan told him that Tess was at Sanbourne, a fashionable seaside resort near Egdon Heath. Clare thanked her and hurried away to catch the next train for Sanbourne. Joan had been unable to give Clare an address. All she knew was the name of the town in which Tess was now living. Clare walked down the fashionable streets of Sanbourne, looking at the shops and restaurants. He wondered what Tess, his young wife, a farm girl, could be doing here. There were no cows to milk, no fields to harvest. He went to the post office and asked if they knew the address of Mrs. Clare. The postman shook his head.
"Or Miss Durbeyfield?"
asked Angel.
"No, but there is someone named Durbeyfield at the Herons."
The postman gave Clare directions to a small, elegant hotel. Clare rang the doorbell of the Herons. The proprietor, Mrs. Brooks, answered the door and said, yes, there was a Mrs. Durbeyfield in the house. She asked Angel to wait in the sitting room and went upstairs to call Tess.
"Oh, dear,"
thought Angel.
"What will she think of me? I have changed so much."
Then he heard Tess's step on the stair and his heart beat painfully. Tess appeared at the door. She was not at all as he had expected. She wore a grey cashmere dressing gown. Her whole appearance was that of an elegant lady with plenty of money.
"Tess,"
he said,
"can you forgive me for going away?"
"It's too late,"
Tess replied, her eyes shining unnaturally.
"I didn't understand, but now I do."
"Too late, too late,"
she said, waving her hand impatiently like someone in great pain.
"Don't come close to me, Angel."
"Don't you love me any more? I know I look different. I've been ill. Please come with me."
I waited and waited for you,
she cried in her musical voice.
But you did not come. He kept saying, your husband will never come back. He helped my family. He won me back to him. Now I hate him because he lied. You have come back. But it's too late.
Angel stood still and silent for a minute when he heard this. Then he said,
oh, it is my fault.
She ran upstairs. After a while, he left the house. Mrs. Brooks had heard part of this conversation from her room, which was opposite the sitting room. Curious, she went upstairs and looked through the keyhole of the door to the d'Urbervilles' apartment. Through the keyhole, she saw the breakfast things she had brought them earlier, and she saw Tess lying on the floor, weeping. She heard Alec's voice ask,
what's the matter?
Tess leapt up and replied with passionate fury. Afraid of being caught listening at the door, Mrs. Brooks went downstairs quickly and quietly and sat in her room. All was now quiet in the d'Urbervilles' room above. After a while, she saw Tess leave the house. Mrs. Brooks rested her head on the back of her chair. Looking up, she noticed a spot the size of a wafer in the middle of the white ceiling. As she looked, the spot grew to the size of a hand. It was red. The rectangular white ceiling, with this red spot in the middle, looked like a gigantic heart. Mrs. Brooks ran upstairs and listened at the d'Urbervilles' door. The only sound was a regular beat. Drip, drip, drip. She opened the door, and there on the bed she saw Alec d'Urberville in a pool of blood with the bread knife in his heart.
Angel! Angel!
Called Tess. Angel turned round and saw her running towards him. She was so pale and breathless that he took her hand and led her off the road into the forest. When they were hidden among the trees, he looked at her.
I have killed him,
she said, and a pitiful white smile lit her face.
What?
I never loved him at all as I love you. I thought you didn't love me any more, so I went back to him. But now I have killed him. So say you love me, Angel.
I love you,
he said, holding her tightly in his arms.
But have you really killed him?
Yes. I was crying after you left. My heart was breaking. He asked me why, and I became so furious I screamed at him. Then he ridiculed me for loving you, and he called you terrible names. And then I did it.
He kissed her and said,
I will not desert you. I will protect you, love, whatever you have done.
At first, Claire did not believe that she had killed d'Urberville. Perhaps she had tried to kill him. Claire's horror at her impulse was mixed with amazement at the strength of her love for himself. Her love seemed to have extinguished her moral sense. Now that she was with Claire again, she seemed content. Nothing else seemed to matter. He looked at her face and thought of the d'Urberville coach. Perhaps the legend arose because the d'Urbervilles had been known to do these things. They walked deeper into the forest. For miles and miles they walked, happy to be together alone at last. At noon, they came to an inn. Angel told Tess to stay hidden among the trees. He entered the inn and returned with enough food for 2 days. They ate in the forest, then walked on. Towards evening, they came to a large house. It stood alone in the forest. On the gate was a sign saying, Furnished Mansion for Rent.
It is empty,
said Tess.
We could spend the night here.
Some of the windows were open. Tess and Angel climbed in through a ground floor window. They went upstairs and into one of the bedrooms. It was a large room full of old-fashioned furniture. In the middle of it was a huge four-poster bed. Angel put down his bag and the package of food. He sat on the bed and said,
Rest at last.
As they ate, Tess told him about the night he carried her across the river and put her in the abbot's coffin.
Why didn't you tell me the next day?
He asked.
Don't think about the past,
she said.
Just think of the present. Who knows what tomorrow will bring?
The next day was cold and rainy. They stayed in the mansion all day and the next night. Angel went out and bought some more food at a shop some miles away. They stayed in the mansion for 5 days. They spoke of the past, but only the distant past, before their wedding day. On the 5th day, Claire said,
"We should leave this place."
"Why?"
asked Tess.
"We are so happy here. Inside this house is contentment. Outside is trouble."
It was true. Inside was love, forgiveness, and peace. Outside was danger.
"I know, my love,"
said Claire.
"But soon someone will come to clean the house. We must not be found here."
The next day was sunny. They travelled north. Soon they came to the edge of the forest. They decided to sleep in the afternoon and continue their journey at night under the cover of darkness. They passed through a silent, sleeping town and onto the plain beyond. After walking for hours, they came upon a great stone structure.
"What is it?"
asked Tess. It was made of enormous blocks of stone. Some stood erect, others were lying on the ground.
"It's Stonehenge,"
said Claire.
"The pagan temple?"
"Yes. It is older than the centuries, older than the d'Urbervilles."
Tess lay down on one of the stone slabs.
"I don't want to go any further,"
she said. Claire knelt down beside her.
"Are you tired? The stone you are lying on looks like an altar."
"Angel, if anything happens to me, will you take care of Liza Lou?"
"I will."
"She is so good and simple and pure. Please marry her if you lose me."
"If I lose you, I lose everything."
Gradually, the sky grew paler and the great blocks of stone stood dark against it.
"Did they sacrifice to God here?"
asked Tess.
"No, I think they worshipped the sun."
"Angel, do you believe we will meet again after death?"
He did not answer, but kissed her instead.
"Oh, I fear that means no,"
she cried, with tears in her eyes. She clasped his hand, but after a while he felt her grip relax in sleep. The great plain was now visible in the morning light. The sun rose behind the sunstone. Light bathed the stone of sacrifice. Claire saw something moving in the distance. He heard footsteps behind him. To his right and his left, he saw men moving towards them. So her story was true. Claire leapt up and looked for a weapon.
"It's no use, sir,"
said one of the men.
"There are 16 of us."
Tess woke up.
"What is it, Angel?"
she asked.
"Have they come for me?"
"Yes, dearest."
"I am almost glad,"
she said.
"This happiness was too much. I have had enough."
Then she turned to the policeman and said,
"I am ready."
On a warm July morning, Angel Clare and Liza Lou climbed the hill above the city of Wintoncester. It was a fine old city, once the capital of Wessex County. Clare and his sister-in-law walked hand in hand, their heads bent with sorrow. She was taller and thinner than Tess, but she had the same eloquent eyes. When they reached the summit of the hill, they looked out over the landscape and the Gothic spires of Wintoncester. The cathedral bells rang 8 o'clock. Claire and Liza Lou started at the sound. They stared down at a large, ugly building in the middle of the city. On one of the building's towers stood a flagpole. A few minutes after the hour had struck, something moved slowly up the flagpole. It was a black flag. Justice was done. The president of the immortals had ended his sport with Tess. The d'Urberville knights and ladies slept on in their tombs unaware. Claire and Liza Lou knelt down on the ground as if in prayer. They remained there a long time. Then they rose, joined hands again, and went on.